Thank you, Don. Good evening. I'm going to start in Matthew tonight. Of course, I start there a lot. And it's on the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know, that really makes an impression on me, is what he has to say in here and why he says it, and just a whole bunch of things. I look at it as his first official sermon. I'm sure he gave talks or teachings or something before that, according to the scriptures, but this is the first sermon he gave that's recorded anyway in the New Testament. And basically, when he got over here to this continent, he gave it again. And if you look at it, as some people say, it's not the same thing. He didn't plagiarize, because he went about it differently. But the other way I look at it is, why would he come over here and teach something different? You know, he teaches the same no matter where he goes. Always has, always will. And that's the depth and that's the beauty of this passage. So I'm going to start in the 5th chapter of Matthew, and I'm going to start with verse 3 just right at the front of it. The Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely, for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. Called Beatitudes. The Blesseds. I've heard it called the Blesseds. What does it mean? I've heard all kinds of interpretations of what those passages mean, what those verses mean. Well, it means what the rest of the scriptures tell us. It means what it does in Galatians, with the fruit of the Spirit. It means the same thing as in Peter, when they talk about things that of behavior and attitude there. It talks about the things that are just all through all the books and all the Bible and the Book of Mormon. But people seem to want to make something more out of it than that. They want to expound upon it, or whatever their agenda is, I guess, is the right way I should say it. But I'm going to start with the first. What does blessed mean? How do you know when you're blessed? Like it says at the first of each one of those verses. Well, see, that was in Aramaic. It was in Greek, to Greek. So he was talking to the people of the time. He wasn't talking to us now, or it wasn't written down for us now. It was written down for a recording of what he said, or a history of what he said. Blessed in Greek means happy. And I don't mean I just got a new pickup truck happy. The ancient Greeks called Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, Amakarios. And that's the way I say it. I don't know whether that's the way you really say it. Which means happy. And the reason they did it is it was so rich and so fertile an island, and of course everything back then was agriculture, or most of it was agricultural, that you could have a perfect life on Cyprus or the Happy Isle. And it became a word, it became an adjective, I guess you'd say, of the time. So when he said, blessed are, they all knew what he was talking about. It was a place of contentment. It was a place of fulfillment. It was a place of everything's right. So when he said, blessed, everything there, it's going to be right with you if you learn how to do this. It's going to be right. All's going to be right with you. For the scriptures, while you're saying things, you're going to prosper. Doesn't mean you're going to get rich with money, but you're going to be safe, you're going to be fed, and you're going to be contented. I ran across a thing quite a few years ago now, an article, I think it was on the internet, that broke out each one of those things and each one of those beatitudes or each one of those verses. And they struck a chord with me because they fit. They just made sense. And you know, that's what the scriptures are supposed to do to us. They're supposed to make sense. Instead of inventing a way to do it, you're supposed to go, oh, I got it, okay, and do it. Because it tells you in many, many places in both books, if you believe these things, see that you do them. Not, if you believe these things, see that you can recite them perfectly, or embellish upon them, or whatever. It says do them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Those who realize that their way is insufficient and they want to completely follow God's instructions in all aspects of their life, that's poor in spirit. You're not insistent on having your own way. You're not insistent on being prideful. You're not looking down on other people. You're not full of yourself. You're humble. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Life brings us the bitterest sorrows that you can get. If you take life seriously. There's a lot of people in this world that just fly through life and don't have a clue. And they can leave havoc and ruin in their wake and never know it because they are just oblivious. And they never learn. I've dealt with a few of those. You probably deal with some of them in your life. He even talks about that when Christ talks about that in further on in one of the Gospels, where they talk about the guy that stood on the street corner and talked about how religious he was, and then he had a guy that was beating his breast and saying, please forgive me for I'm a sinner, and I'm paraphrasing it. But that's what they mean. That's what that means. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Those who have endured the bitter sorrow that life brings, and those who are very sorry for their own sin and unworthiness. Blessed are the meek. Is practicing being meek an art with you? Do you have to affect some kind of an action or some kind of a saying to be meek? Or do you put other people first? Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. I don't know of anybody, I know of one man really that was hungry. It was my brother-in-law, Lauren Bryant. When he was a prisoner of war in North Korea, pretty soon soap tasted pretty good. That's what he told us. That's hungry. So if you want to hunger and thirst after righteousness, how do you know what hungry and being thirsty is? You fast? You get hungry? What does that do to your attitude? What does that do to your spirit? What does that do to your demeanor? How, with that kind of a pressure, and that's pressure, that's stress, what do you do when you have to react to things and make decisions under that kind of stress? So what does hunger and thirsting after righteousness mean? Righteousness means to obey. That's all it means. Go look it up in any dictionary you want. The only thing right to be righteous is you just obey. So if you're looking for righteousness in this context here, you want to do what God has told us to do so badly that it blankets everything else. And not so you can be religious. It's so you can be right. Because you know it works, that right works. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. We have and have had for decades a real good example of what non-mercy is in the civilizations and the countries in the Mideast. The hate and the anger and the violence, and therefore nobody gets ahead as far as humanity goes. Forget the health issues, forget being fed, forget safety, forget shelter. We're going to shoot you and we're going to bomb you. And that's what they do to each other. And they've done it for centuries. Well, take and turn that around. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart. Those who completely abandon their own agenda in favor of God's principles. That's the only way you can do that. You can't do it being selfish. You can't do it being egotistical. You can't do it with any of the things that are of the world. To be pure in heart, you have to completely be convinced that you are going to follow what God teaches us for behavior. Blessed are the peacemakers. Now this was in Jewish times. He was talking to the Jews then. And in Jewish it means doing that which is needed for the good of all. It does not mean being a pacifist, a peacemaker. Little different twist. But that's what he was talking about back then. Doing things which are for the good of all. And we understand that concept. But do we attach it to that phrase? Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. You know, that's one of the worst things that we hear in this part of the world. And I'm talking not just this country, but here. That's one of our biggest problems, is being persecuted for righteousness' sake. And you know how they do it? They ignore you. They ridicule you. I don't believe anybody here has been shot at for being a Christian. I don't believe anybody's been jailed here for being a Christian. Has in other parts of this country, and has been very recently, that have been shot and killed for being Christians, but we haven't. So the only thing that's been hurt so far for us is our pride and our ego, if we've been ridiculed or ignored. Because when we have everything else like this country has, that's where our emphasis is on our pride and on our ego. It's on us. And that can be just as damaging as being shot, because it can destroy your soul, left uncorrected. Ye are the salt of the earth, but if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is there thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. Let your light shine, so shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Those are actions. Those are actions that are driven by your attitude or by your spirit. And those are actions that are driven by what I just talked about in the Beatitudes. So it's instruction. It's not just something to recite. It's not something to memorize and verbally regurgitate whenever is appropriate. It's something to do. It's really something to do. And it's hard to do it because we're human beings. We think we have our own will. Well, we do. We have our own will. We have our own logic. We have our own wisdom. We have our own priorities. And way too often, those things get in the way of what God wants us to do, of getting in the way of what He designed us originally to do, and then gave us the instructions on how to follow it. And we forget to look and follow. We all do it. I do it. And I don't think I'm different from anybody else. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, and one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law until all be fulfilled. Because what God caused to be recorded, what God caused to be put down, He meant. I don't think there's anything that's what you would call superfluous or needless or any of those things that are in the scriptures. These scriptures are supposed to be important to us. They're supposed to be our instruction manual or our first aid kit for our soul or however you want to say that. That's what these scriptures are for. And they mean something. But they don't just mean something to be an academic exercise. They mean something for us to do. And we've got to understand to do it. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, and we know what that is, we know who they are, we know their history, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. And then he changes the way he talks. He changes the subject a little bit. And for me, he starts telling me what restoring the gospel means. You ever heard that phrase before? The restoration of the gospel? First few times I was up in Alaska, we had a couple of members up there, but we had quite a few people up there. There was a group of dissidents, I guess you'd say, from the RLDS Church, and they had come from various walks of life and various different splinter groups within there, and they were all pretty much soured on that way of doing things as far as church goes, and they called themselves the Old Saints. And they appointed their elders, and they did all of this stuff. And the first thing I heard when I started going up there is, now you know we only have 10% of the gospel. Now you know we only have 10% of the gospel. And just about every time that you started a conversation with them about the scriptures, that's what you got first. And I figured out pretty soon what they were talking about. Because they were looking for the other 90%. If I wanted to put any credence to we only have 10% of the gospel, we've got a record of the Nephites and the Lamanites here. That's one record. Out of 10 lost tribes, that's 10%. But I don't think that's what they meant. Because we went through all kinds of real interesting conversations and discussions and things up there about what they perceived to be religious and what they perceived to be the gospel. And boy, you couldn't find any of it in the scriptures. Example. We were going to have a rally up there. So I was supposed to be in charge of the rally. So we sat down to plan out the schedule. First thing those elders asked me was, what's your specialty? And I go, I beg your pardon? And they said, well, you're an elder, what's your specialty? I said, I don't understand. He said, well, they said, if you're an elder, you got to have a specialty. So finally I said, well, my specialty is preaching repentance. And they go, oh, no, not that. You have to have a specialty. Well, they never really told me what a specialty was, but when one of them got up to give his sermon, his specialty was that he could stand up behind the pulpit and he could look out on the congregation, and anybody that had a black tornado over their head had the Spirit with them. That was his specialty. And his service or his sermon consisted of naming those people that had that black tornado over their head, and then we sat down, and that was the end of his sermon. Then I knew what my specialty was, preaching repentance. And boy, did I buckle down. But they were continually looking. From what I understand now, they have found something new, because that's what they kept telling me. We're looking for something new. We know all of this other stuff, but they didn't act like they knew it. We're looking for something new, because we only have 10%. And the fortunes and fame of those people up there would rise and fall on what they thought was something new that they'd take to the group. I understand there's a person here in Independence that has taken the Book of Mormon and he's made it a poem. It's all poetic. And they found that about 10 years ago. That was their something new. Now, what does the Book of Mormon in poetry form do? You know, I believe the Book of Mormon's information, its instruction, its history, it's what those people did right and what those people did wrong, just like the Bible. Only that was in South America instead of over in the Mideast. And it was a different civilization, but they still made the same mistakes. That's why Christ came over here and preached the Sermon on the Mount. But why did he have to preach the Sermon on the Mount? I've covered that first part. But why did he have to do what I'm about to read? Verse 21. Ye have heard that it was said to them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. I don't know about you, but I went over that several times before it dawns on me that thou shalt not kill in verse 21 is in Exodus 20:30. And in my Bible, it's in capital letters. It's called a reference. Now, this is the New Testament. So why should he be referring to the Old Testament? You know, he's supposed to be bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's supposed to be bringing these things to us. Well, it's because in the first place, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time. It doesn't say it is written, because they never read their scriptures. Those rabbis never read the Torah. Even though it was something of high value to them, and they, with great ceremony, would parade it around in their synagogues during their services. It's because they got it wrong. Because they hadn't, over the, through 2,000-3,000 years, between the time that it was originally written down and the time that Jesus Christ is teaching it, they was a half a mile off with what they thought it meant. Because they never went back and read their scriptures. When I first started studying things like this, I'd go over to Steele's Christian Books over in Northtown. I'd go to any place that had a Judica section in their references, you know, like libraries or bookstores or whatever. And I'd get out all these Jewish writings. And after a while, it dawned on me that what I was reading was, well, Rabbi so-and-so has said that it's this way, this phrase is this way, but I think it's this. And then Rabbi such-and-such, you know, he thinks it's this way. But Rabbi so-and-so has said it was this, but he thinks it's that way. Now, what's going on here? Nobody is saying it is written. Everybody takes what the guy in the previous installment or generation or whatever you want to call it, they took what they said and reinterpreted it to what they thought it meant. Well, you know how the game of gossip goes. We've all been involved in that at one time, brother. You know how far off the original phrase gets when you get to the end of six people. Try 3,000 years. From now on, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, is the first of every one of his subjects. So what was he doing? He was restoring the gospel as it was originally intended to be. Why would they do that? Why would they not pay attention to what was already written down? Because it's human. And we're human. And we're not the only ones that do it. Muhammad, when he was, what, about 600 AD, I think it was, when he started, writing the Quran. But when he started the same place that the Torah started. And at the Old Testament started, he started with Abraham. But that's the only really commonality that there is, that all three of those religions started at Abraham. The Muslims said that the eldest son was always the one that got everything. So when Abraham put his son on the altar at God's command to be sacrificed, he put Ishmael on there, according to the Muslims, not Isaac, as the Jews and the Christians did. And that's explained later on, after that incident, that's explained in the Old Testament. Because Ishmael wasn't the legitimate son. Isaac was. But even at that, when Muhammad wrote the Quran, then people immediately started taking it and changing it. And Muhammad was basically a peace-loving man. There's a Professor Cahil Muhammad, who's a professor of religious studies in San Diego State University. He had an article recently that he put out about the Quran and how people look at Muslims and stuff today. And he teaches Muslims and non-Muslims. And he says, I'm successful because I get them both upset. He maintains that the word jihad, you know what the word jihad means today. We see it all over the news. People die, things are destroyed in jihads. Has been ever since, what, the Gulf War, I think, or before that. The original definition of the word jihad is to exert oneself, and that's it. To make yourself better for God, that's a jihad. It's almost as if they need another Sermon on the Mount for them to redefine what jihad originally meant. Fatwa, I guess that's the way you say it, was nothing more than an observation. It wasn't an order, and it was only given by Muslim scholars. every extremist over there today that's in charge of a terrorist group gives fatwas, which are orders to go kill, to go do jihads. So we're not alone in changing stuff that was originally written, in changing the meaning of things. Do we do it? Yep, we do it. A long time back, I started hearing things about what I just read over here. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And if you go over to, let's see, where is it over here? Verse 70 on page 637 in the Book of Mormon. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of his judgment. Doesn't say without a cause. And I've always heard, well, they just, when they wrote the King James Version, they just put it in there because they wanted to justify something. And I've heard that. Sometime back, and it's been quite a while back, I got on my computer and I looked up that phrase in the Bible. And it occurs 60 times. Most of it's in the Old Testament. So I started looking. When I read this thing about the Quran, that brought me back to this without a cause. And I got to looking. And I'm going to read to you what I found. I'm going to go back to Exodus 22:9. Yeah, I'm going back to the Old Testament. I'm going back to the first five books of the Bible. Exodus and Deuteronomy and most of those, and Leviticus, most of that content in there is laws and rules on how to be civilized. And that's the real, real short definition of it as far as I'm concerned. How to be a human being. Don't hit, share, be nice, you know, all of those things. So in 22, I'm going to just start with verse 7. Now you may think I'm off base here, but stick with me for a couple of three passages here and I'll show you where I'm headed with this. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he hath put his hand into his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox or for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. That's the first cause. What do we call that today? Court case. That's what we call it. That's what I call it for 33 years. It's what they taught me in the police academy. They still teach in the police academy? He's saying, yeah. The cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. Exodus 23. Thou shalt not raise a false report, but not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. But thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to wrest judgment. In other words, you're not going to lie in a court case. That's what that means. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldst forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help him with it. Thou shalt not wrest the judgment of the poor in his cause. That's a definition of cause. Deuteronomy 1. I'm not going to read all 60. I'm going to start with verse 15 in Deuteronomy 1. So I took the chief of your tribe, the wise men and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands and captains over hundreds and captains over fifties and captains over tens and officers among your tribes. And that starts in Exodus 18. What that is, when I was at work, we called it a table of organization, a TO. You know, chief, majors, captains, lieutenants, sergeants, patrolmen. It's a TO, table of organization. And you have a span of control. In here it's 10. So you even had a span of control back then. And I charge your judges at that time, saying, hear the causes between your brethren, and judge righteously between every man and his brother and the stranger that is with him. Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but you shall hear the small as well as the great, and you shall not be afraid of the face of man. For the judgment is God's, and the cause is that is too hard for you, bring it unto me, and I will hear it. Are we starting to form an opinion about what that word means, and as far as the Bible goes? Let me try one more here. Number 16, I'm going to start with verse 10. And he hath brought thee near to him, and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee. And seek ye the priesthood also, for which cause both thou and all thy company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron that ye murmur against him? That word cause in the Bible is just like the word cause or any other word in the English language. It all depends on how you're using it is what it means. And there's a lot of places in the Bible where the word cause is without the word a in front of it. But every time that there's a word a in front of it, when you go back and look, it's a court case. So why is it in the Bible and it's not in the Book of Mormon that way? First place is two different societies. And if you want to go to this in the Book of Mormon, that passage, where was it here now? Now I've lost it, I didn't mark it. If you go into Ephesians and Colossians and about maybe a dozen other places in the New Testament, that's the perfect mirror of what it says in the Book of Mormon. So it's not that the Book of Mormon's wrong. The Book of Mormon's right, but so's the Bible. And it was Jesus that used that without a cause in the Bible, and he uses it again in John 15. But they recognized what the word cause meant, but they also recognized what the word a cause meant. See, I got this problem. I don't believe there's any contradictions in the Bible, and I don't believe there's any contradictions in the Book of Mormon, and I don't believe there's any contradictions between them. And the reason I believe that is that I have found out that if there's a contradiction, I make it because of the way I read something. And I don't know how many times that I've stumbled over something, and all I got to do is remember, there's no contradictions here. Bruner, you're the one that's making them. And you go back and look at it with a new set of eyes. And if you look and if you're honest about it, you're going to find out that there is no contradiction. I'll give you a real easy one. Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot betrayed Christ. Then he repented. Then he went and threw the 30 pieces of silver back to the Sanhedrin, I think it was. I haven't looked it up lately. And then what did he do? Well, in one gospel, he went out and hung himself. But in another gospel, he fell and his bowels burst. Now, which one's right? Well, they both are. And this is gross. Back then, if you hung yourself, your body was unclean and they didn't touch you. But that couldn't go on forever. So what the rabbis decided was that after you rotted enough or decomposed enough that when you were hanging there, when your head came off and the rest of you fell and hit the ground, then they had to clean you up. So one of them said he went out and hung himself. The other said when he fell and he burst open, my paraphrasing, and they're both right. As long as you go look for it. But the first thing you got to do is have faith that there's no contradictions. Many places in the Old Testament, that word cause does not mean what it means there in Matthew. And here's the reason that Matthew put it in that way. And it's in my commentary on the book of Matthew. I've got a commentary that gives order of the gospel, the authorship, the dates, and all of that stuff at the front of each one of my books in this Bible. And now I've looked up and I've lost it again. I know it's right in the middle. All I got to do is find it. If I quit getting in a hurry here. Matthew's emphasis on the Old Testament preparation for the gospel makes it an ideal bridge from the Old to the New Testament. The gospels present four portraits of Jesus, each in its own characteristic manner. Matthew, the Hebrew tax collector, writes for the Hebrew mind. There's my key. They understand what for a cause means because it's been in their world since Exodus. Mark, the travel companion of Peter and Paul, writes for the Roman mind. Luke, Paul's physician missionary, writes with the Greek mentality in view. And John's gospel is different by nature from the other three. So it all depends on where the guy come from. Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John is how he wrote. The cool part about that is they all say the same thing, even though they came from four different walks and from four different tribes, if you want to say it that way, or from four different ways of life. There is the corroboration. There is, in the mouths of two or three witnesses, all things are established. But that's why it's in Matthew is because Matthew was writing it for the Hebrews, and the Hebrews knew exactly what he meant. When Christ came over here and gave the same thing, he didn't say it that way. There's a lot of things that he said differently in the Sermon on the Mount in the Mideast and the Sermon on the Mount here. If their right eye offend thee, pluck it out. If the right hand offend thee, cut it off. See, that's the way that they talked over there. What does that bring to your mind if I say that? That's what they did. That was a way of saying it. He didn't say it in the Book of Mormon that way. But he says the same thing, but he says it the way we understand it. Back about, I don't know, mid-80s, there was a man that probably was a little short on being sharp, I guess is the way of saying it, out here in Blue Springs. That was sitting in a sermon in his church on Sunday morning, and his pastor read that. and apparently he had just done something he was pretty ashamed of. So when they said, "If they're right, I offend thee, pluck it out," he stood up and said, "Well, I have offended." And he popped his eye out right there in the congregation. End of church service. My question is, how many right eyes you got? So you're only allowed one? I mean, if you're going to think about it. How many right hands do you have? You have one. What caused the offense in the first place? Your mind. So it's a manner of talking. It's a way they said things. It's the way they talked, which is different from ours. And Jesus knew that from the Mideast to this continent. But he taught exactly the same thing. When we look up and we see what we think is a contradiction, or what we think, well, you know, it's just something that they put in the Bible. No. See, I'm also a firm believer in that God is going to make real sure that his information stays on this earth for those who want to read it. I don't care what other people do with the Bible. He's going to make sure it stays. And when he caused King James, who wasn't the nicest person in the world, to cause that this King James Bible be compiled, and in the way that I understand that they went about compiling it, took them from 1605 to 1611, their first rule, in the mouths of the way we say it, in the mouths of 2 or 3 witnesses, all things are established. That was their first rule with those scholars and theologians. Nothing in the Bible will be included. None of the books that are in all these other Bibles, and that's what the problem was. None of these books will be in a Bible unless it's corroborated by all the other books. In other words, they all got to teach the same thing. Well, they do. All 66 of them. And the other thing that gets me is, if when you have people today, when they talk about the Book of Mormon, this is in Revelation 22, "For I testify unto every man that heareth the word of the prophecy of this book, if any man shall add unto these things, God shall add unto him the plagues that are written in this book. And if any man shall take away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part out of the book of life and out of the holy city and from the things which are written in this book." And then they say, "And that's why we don't believe in the Book of Mormon." Problem is, Revelation was the book. It was written by John on the Isle of Patmos. We know that. Well, he was in exile. It was written in such a way that he could get his information to his followers through the Roman censors who had put him in exile on the Isle of Patmos. But it was a book. It was a book for hundreds of years. For hundreds of years. It was the book. That's what he wrote about. It wasn't part of the Bible until 1611. 1,000 years or more later. And he didn't know, I'm sure, that it was going to be part of the Bible. What he meant was, anything that teaches things different, any writing that teaches things differently than what's written in this book, and in other words, in Revelations, that's what it means. And all you got to do is look at the 66 books in the Bible and look at these over here in the Book of Mormon, and they teach exactly the same thing. If you want to see something that teaches different, go to a Protestant bookstore and look at the commentaries. It goes all the way from the far left to the far right. And I know they're not all the same. There's where the adding to and taking away is. One of my things is that the Bible is true and the Book of Mormon is true. You know, and they say they're as one in your hand, or the Book of Mormon is a witness unto the Bible. All of the things that we've always said about it is true. It's honestly true. But when you start saying, well, okay, that can't be true over here because of what it says over here, You're taking away. I don't care if it's this much you're taking away, and it's this much per generation is what they did for centuries, for millennia, from the Deuteronomy and Genesis and all of that up until Matthew. And then you see what Jesus Christ had to do to straighten it all out. One of the things that I like about this church, we read. When I say I'm going to go to Revelation 21, a goodly number of you I see do this. And then I start hearing pages turn. You're reading along with me. It's what you're supposed to do. Sadly enough, I've heard ministry stand behind this pulpit and start quoting scriptures without touching it. And you read along with them and they're not saying the right thing. They're not saying it right. And if you believe them, it's tragic. You should be saying what is talked about. There's no more of this. It hath been said by them of old. It should not be. Many of those places in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Book of Mormon, it says, behold, it is written. Well, why did it say that? Because they had the plates. The brass plates were brought over. You know, the layman and all of that, with Lamoni and all of that. He was killed to bring those plates over here. Not Lamoni. Who am I thinking of? Laban, that's right. Thank you. Why? Because it was important. And because God knew that they would keep that going. Do you know what I hear now about the plates? Not from this church, but from other churches. The gold plates. How in the world do they go from brass to gold? To make it neater? To make it more expensive or exotic? I don't know. But I don't think they went from brass to gold. I think they stayed brass. Because that wasn't the point. The point was what was written on them. There's where the treasure is. And that's where this treasure came from. And that's where this treasure came from. I told you in times past that I went to a school down in Florida. They called it a executive school. And what this thing was on how to deal with people. It was a police executive school, and that's exactly all it was. It was for weeks, for months. They taught us how to deal with people, how to deal with problems. And any administrator of any group of any size has probably been through these kind of schools. And they're totally invaluable to me, as far as I'm concerned. But this one, it was all on human behavior. And we had an instructor who was a retired policeman from Waco, Texas, and he was one of our instructors. And he would teach some facet of human behavior for his class that day. And then when he would give the recap, and every day at the end of his class, he'd say, just like it says in the scriptures. He wouldn't give me the book, wouldn't give me the chapter, wouldn't give you the verse, but it didn't take too long to go find it. And I believed him because he was right every time. And that's where I became a big fan of these books is for me to learn how to behave and to help other people along their way. Exodus chapter 18, verse 13. This is one of the lessons. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses set to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. Now, how many people came across the Red Sea do we figure? Roughly 2 to 3 million. 2 to 3 million people, about the size of Jackson County. A lot of people, a lot of problems, a lot of disagreements, a lot of arguments. lot of stuff going on. A lot of decisions that had to be made by judges or somebody. And Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning until the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, "What is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto even?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come unto me to inquire of God, and when they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." He was the judge for several million people, and he did it all day long. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, "The thing that thou doest is not good. Thou wilt surely wear away, both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone." That's called workload. I helped computerize the police department here back in the 80s. There's all kinds of data you acquire when you do that. Of course, ours was workloads. One of the things was workloads. You had all these different kinds of calls that you ran. General information call, alarm calls, ambulance calls, shootings, robberies, all kinds of calls. Maybe 24 or more different classifications of calls. So we gave each one a number that went to the computer. Each time one of those calls came up, they hit that number, it went to the computer. From the time the call taker picked up the phone till the time the car that handled a call went back in service was the time it took to handle a call. Some calls took 5 minutes. Some calls took 4 hours, depending on what happened. Where the call occurred went in. Who did the call went in? We had the city cut into districts. The district that it occurred in went in. And after a while, you started seeing a pattern. Here's where all the activity was for this stuff. Here's where all the activity for this stuff. Here's all the activity for this stuff. Workload. You have complaints. Officers getting mad. Officers losing their cool. Officers making mistakes in judgment. Officers doing all kinds of things. It's a problem. In this school, I found out. Well, and the other thing is, most of your decisions that you make in that line of work are stress-related. They taught that if a police officer has to make stress decisions over 65% of the time during his work period, he's going to get so stressed he's going to start making mistakes. And there's the complaints. So what we did with that computer is we took the type of call, we took how long it took to handle that call, we took how long or where the call was, how many times that call occurs, all this stuff, and we put it in a printout. And then we overlaid the district outlines on it. And it didn't take anybody any brains at all to see that some guys were completely overloaded and some guys didn't have anything to do at all comparatively. So we realigned the districts to handle the workload, to even out the workload. Complaints went down. That's exactly what he's talking about here. That's exactly what I just read. "Hearken now unto my voice, I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and they shall show them the way wherein they must walk and the work that they must do. Moreover, that thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and truth, and places such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds and rulers of fifties and rulers of tens. First table of organization. His span of control was 10. It's in the Bible. So's the military draft. So's a whole bunch of things that's part or have been part of our daily lives, and it's all in the Old Testament. It's scriptural. All we have to do is recognize it as such and go back and see how it was written, how it was written, and then take a look at how we've done it and how it's migrated from here to here over the millennia and what we do with it. But it all starts back with, are you a man of God? Because if you're a man of God, you're going to hunger and thirst after righteousness, right? So you're going to do it right. If you're not a man of God, then you're not a man of righteousness, and you're going to do whatever you want to fulfill your agenda. And it's usually a selfish agenda. That's what makes these books so important. A family can follow these rules and they'll work. IBM could follow these rules and it would work. Didn't make any difference how many. The pattern's laid there. And if you follow it, and if you really hunger and thirst after righteousness, it works. Period. We go through all of these things. Where does it talk about, and I just hit a blank, where does it talk about the milk and the meat of the gospel? That's in Hebrew, isn't it? How far are we along in our spiritual life? What do we expect to see when we, quote, get there in our spiritual life? In other words, when we have arrived in our spiritual life as we want to understand it, where are we? Hebrews, 5th chapter. And I'm going to start in mid-sentence here. I'm going to start with verse 11. Of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing that you are dull of hearing. Now this is Paul talking to the Hebrews about this new thing called the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he's trying to teach them the difference between the law and the gospel. For when the time you ought to be teachers, ye have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. For everyone that useth milk is unskillful in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. Unskillful in the word of righteousness. Understanding what you're supposed to do. You're unskillful with the milk of the gospel. That's what he says. But strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection. That's pretty heavy, really. It really means something. Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection, not laying again the foundation of repentance from dead works, of faith toward God, of the doctrine of baptism, and the laying on of hands, and the resurrection of the dead, and of eternal judgment. This we will do if God permit. That's the milk. We all believe that. I mean, I believe it. How many times? I don't know any other foreign language, so I'm not going to tell you in any other language. I believe that. I don't need to be told that. there, it doesn't hurt to be reminded, but I don't need to be told that. I know that, and so do you. But the strong meat belongeth to them that are of full age, even to those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. That's the meat. I'm still learning. And why am I still learning? Because I'm a human being. I have what I think is my own logic. I have what I think is my own wisdom. I have my own ego. I tend to be greedy. I tend to be selfish. And when you do all of that stuff, if you want to justify your actions, you can sure mess up good and evil. That's why we should be here. It's to learn to discern good and evil. How many times in this world, or how many times even in your conversation among people out here in the world during the week, do you see a mix-up where they don't know the difference between those two because they don't want to, because they want to justify what they do and feel comfortable with it? Do we do that? Yes. To one degree, yes. Getting ready to quit here as long as I can find what I'm looking for. I went to get my hair cut the other day. My barber and I, we really had some discussions about things. Sometimes you get pretty deep. It's a lot of fun, even though it don't take long cutting my hair anymore. I found out that he was a basketball coach when his kids were growing up. And he says, when I first started being a coach here in the grade school level of things, you know, all the basics, learning to dribble, learning not to travel, you know, how to shoot a basketball and that kind of stuff. He said, we had one coach in our group. We had one team that they won all their games. And all the coaches were jealous of him. He says, and I was a new guy. He says, I didn't know to be jealous of this guy. He says, I was still learning. So I just went to him and I says, you know, you're pretty good. He says, what makes you, how can your team win all the time? And he said, well, it's real simple. He said, first off, he says, nobody's ever asked me that before. He says, but there is a reason. He says, I teach them the basics. I teach them to dribble. I teach them not to travel. I teach him to pass off to the guy who's, clear. I teach him where to shoot the basketball from and where not to. I teach him the basics, and that's all I teach him. He says, and the other thing is, we never sit around during practice. He says, I have an hour and a half practice, and they're moving all the time. Therefore, they're in shape, and they don't run out of steam in the third quarter. He says, but when I did that, we began winning. And all he taught was the basics. How many times do we forget our basics? Well, this is what King Benjamin said about the basics. And finally, I cannot tell you all the things whereby ye may commit sin. I'm on page 223 in the Book of Mormon. For there are divers ways and means, even so many that I cannot number them. But this much I can tell you, that if you do not watch yourselves, now here's the basics, if you do not watch yourselves and your thoughts and your words and your deeds and observe to keep the commandments of God and continue in the faith of what you've heard concerning the coming of our Lord, even to the end of your lives, comma, ye must perish. You can't get any more basic than that as far as I'm concerned. You don't have to have a list of sins. You just got to watch yourself. And you should never forget the basics and do them. And then you won't perish. Thank you for your time.